This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, wrapping up a second program with 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California, originally from Duluth, Minnesota, and at different times along an Air Force career that spanned from the 30s to the 60s. He was a temporary resident of all kinds of interesting locations around the globe. Mr. Farwell was a prisoner of war in Germany during World War II. Of course, a few months after he was liberated, World War II came to an end thanks to America's use of nuclear technology at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 15 years later, you didn't need a B-29 to drop a nuclear bomb. Intercontinental ballistic missiles had become a reality. In fact, that warhead on an Atlas missile 15 years after World War II was 100 times more powerful, 100 times more powerful than the bomb dropped on Nagasaki. The different iterations of Atlas missiles were followed by the Titan, the Titan II, the Minuteman, and our guest today was involved with all of those at a time when global tensions were fierce. So we're into the 1960s now. You're stationed at Norton Air Force Base in San Bernardino. And what all were you doing there?
I was made the deputy for civil engineering for the missile base stuff. And I had a responsibility for the engineering and oversight for the Atlas, the Titan, and the Minuteman, and a very, very limited advanced missile program that developed into the satellite kind of program that we're running now. But it was a very low-key effort at the time. Any aircraft and any missile program combined.
The Atlas and the Titan and Titan IIs, it was your job to draw up the plans or oversee the plans for the silos they would launch out of?
Yeah, that's right. Every place where we had missiles, we also had to build maintenance facilities, the basic weapon building where the weapons would come in, be assembled, warheads attached, and then taken to the sites. And each base had to have what we called a missile assembly building and a highly classified technically building to receive and store and activate the warheads.
I always try to imagine what it would be like to be doing your job or to be in your shoes, and it seems to me like you had to feel a great deal of responsibility. You know, you're always going to be responsible for your wife and kids, but in a lot of ways, you had a lot of the nation's responsibility on your shoulders.
Well, you did, and you felt it. You felt a very high level of responsibility to see that things happened and that they didn't go wrong, that they were right, and all of the work you were doing was not only important, but it was done right and it was going to be effective. It was a sobering task, frankly.
I would imagine so. And how often did you think about the real reason that you were doing this and the destructive power that these missiles could unleash if they had to be deployed?
It was important for us to get them built, get them established, get them in service. For one thing, we felt that if they were there, they were ready, that they were going to prevent a war and we would no longer need the B-29s and everything else that we still have going strong. And it's worked. We haven't had a war. We haven't had anything, a serious disruption. The Russian is no longer a threat whatsoever. In fact, no country is a threat anymore. The only real threats that we have today are the so-called terrorists and people like the Taliban and so on. Otherwise, things are in pretty safe mode.
Were there times during all those years, and obviously the Cuban Missile Crisis is one that comes to mind that a lot of people would gravitate toward, but were there times while you were working on this that you thought America may have to use these missiles, that something might actually happen?
That was in the back of your mind. What you wanted to do is make sure that if that ever happened, you know, the thing was going to work. As time went on, though, it became a feeling that, you know, it really wasn't going to happen, that things were getting calmer and that, you know, it was all going to work out all right. And so far it has.
Have you ever thought about or tried to quantify how many different missile sites or even missile silos that are there as a result of what you did?
Oh, Lordy. I sighted all the Atlas E's, and I was responsible for the design of the facilities for all of the Atlas F's, Titan, Titan II's. After that, the communication networks tied it all together.
When you think back about that entire Cold War period, and I know for the latter half of it, you were out of the service, still working in related industries, but what do you feel like your contribution was? Do you feel like you helped keep Americans safe, that you helped keep the U.S. out of global war?
I think I did important work in missile design and the communications systems that we put out all over the world, as well as being responsible for building quite a few airbases around the world. I don't dwell on it or try to articulate it, but the fact is I'm pretty proud of the work I did and its impact on providing safety for the American people. I'm proud of that.
You should be. I realize this is a tough question to answer, but with the unique role that you played and the access you had to different things, what's your best estimate or evaluation of how close we came to that mutual destruction that so many people feared when America and the USSR were both with their finger on the trigger?
Very, very close. The ones that people remember most and that much has been written about is, of course, the case when Kennedy was president. We put a Thor missile in Turkey. We had missiles in the UK. As a result, the Russians were going to put missiles in Cuba. And you remember that. That was a very, very tricky time period that could have led to a bloody war. Fortunately, we stayed resolved, and Khrushchev finally backed off and called off his ships that were carrying missiles and warheads to Cuba, and that was the end of it. We took our missiles out of Europe that were aimed at the Russians, and the Russians stayed out of Cuba. And that's where we are today. We've had, in this country, Minuteman missiles aimed at Russian targets for decades now. Since the Russians theoretically are no longer our enemy, I don't have any idea where our Minuteman missiles and Triton missiles on submarines are targeted. They probably have multiple targets. Hopefully they'll never be used.
Amen. And I'm just, again, I'm trying to get to what it must have been like for you. And with you having awareness and knowledge that the general public did not have, so you're aware in the 1960s that all these missiles are pointed at Russia and all it needs is the command and they'll be on their way, and then there's probably something coming back the other way.
Pointed at us too, and we know that. And they're capable of intercontinental missiles, no question about it. I was optimistic enough to feel that it would never happen. There was no point in dwelling on it, no point in worrying about it, and so I never did, frankly. I just did not expect anything like that to ever happen, and fortunately, it hasn't.
There's a little medal in your office back there that not too many guys can claim. In fact, I've interviewed 500 or 600 veterans, and I think I've only met a couple that were awarded the Legion of Merit. What did that mean to you when you found out you were receiving that prestigious award from our government?
It was very exciting and very fulfilling. I didn't know about it until the retirement ceremony. General O'Neill tacked on the Legion of Merit on me, and that was very important. I was very, very happy with that. It's a good achievement. I'm proud of it.
When you think back about your entire career in the service and beyond, what are the things that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, I had a successful flying career. I trained a lot of pilots in different airplanes, and I trained cadets for a full year here at Minner Field. I spent 2 years training B-17 crews and pilots. That's pretty satisfying. And then ended up, flying a lot. I ended up with over 4,000 hours. I had about 1,300 hours in a and a B-17, and just a scattering of several hundred hours on different airplanes.
Was there a favorite plane that you flew?
Well, obviously the B-17, and I have a lot of time, and others do. I ended up with probably 1,400 hours in a C-47, because when the war was over, of course, there were no B-17s to fly. And so you flew a mix of airplanes, AT-6s, C-45s, B-24s, odds and ends all the time, and a little bit of B-29 time. I enjoyed flying. Wish I was still doing it.
If you had a chance to fly to Washington, D.C. to see the World War II Memorial with a bunch of other World War II veterans, would you want to do that?
Yeah, I'd like to do that. I know they had one here a couple of months ago, and I understand they're going to have another one. And I'd be happy to go with them.
What about the cockpit? If they stuck you in that seat, you think you could manage things?
Oh, of course I could. It's been, 40, 50 years since I've flown an airplane, but I'm convinced I could still do it.
I'm not surprised. One thing I've noticed about you don't seem to get too caught up in any of the emotions of this, or you don't seem overly sentimental, but when I think back what you've told me about being a prisoner of war, here you are, a young man, you've got a wife back home, you don't have any children. You ever think about the fact that if you didn't survive getting shot down, if you didn't survive 8 months as a prisoner of war, your two sons would have never been born, and all these things we've talked about today would have never happened?
Well, I don't dwell on it, but you can't help but thinking about that on occasion. I was very fortunate, very lucky. It's gratifying to a certain degree to realize that you lived through all of this and survived and are still healthy. I've got a pain in the back every now and then, but I'm still playing golf a couple of times a week. I have two sons and a family that I see quite frequently.
Can you still shoot your age on the golf course?
I have several times. I shot my age when I was 92. I haven't made it during 93, but I'll hope I'll do it for again. But I first shot my age when I was 86. And I came close when I was 70. I was playing the Bakersfield Inn and Country Club, and I shot a 34 on the front side. And I thought, geez, if I can bar the back side, I'll shoot a 70. I didn't make it. I shot a 74.
But you got it at 86 and 87, 88, so on and so forth. Did it again last year at 92, and I'm trusting a 93 is in your future. Thanks for taking us through your past, and I hope that honor flight trip is in your future too. That is 93-year-old Robert Farwell of Bakersfield, California. Next week, we're going to catch some living history at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco, where there are a couple of Navy vessels that can take you back in time to World War II. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.